Think about how well those interventions worked. When we shut the bars and the nightclubs and had the restaurants go back to takeout through the month of July, there was a 75% reduction in community spread. That was the intervention. Plus, the governor finally allowed the cities and counties to have face covering ordinances. Those two things really did a terrific job at slowing the spread of this thing.
Both of these vaccines are a testament to some huge advances in modern research and modern biotechnology. The idea that we could have vaccines this good in under a year from the development of a new virus is astonishing, and still done with excellent science and still done with careful procedures.
Science had a good year and a bad year. The bad year was all of this preprint stuff came out and was taken as gospel right away. We learned that good science takes time, but the scientific method has illuminated the dark ever since it came about. And we now live in a world where I got vaccinated because of a scientific freaking miracle that continues to happen every day.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the final Vitalist Spark podcast of 2020. I'm your host, John Ford, and we are finishing this year with our 20th COVID-19 roundtable, a milestone we couldn't have predicted at this time last year. This episode comes just after emergency use authorization for a second vaccine from Moderna. It also arrives among very long shadows cast by record high new daily and weekly case counts, record high hospitalizations, and unthinkable numbers of deaths. The U.S. is experiencing fatality rates that are equivalent to or greater than a daily 9/11. Some realities of how we're handling this pandemic have become maddeningly frustrating. Meanwhile, other realities have to be acknowledged as part of a learning curve. And still others, like getting two highly effective vaccines developed in less than a year, are to be celebrated. We're going to touch on all three of those realities in today's discussion. What can you do this holiday season? Please enjoy it, safely. That means not only should you wash up, mask up, and keep a heads up for your fellow Arizonans, it also means that we've got to slow down the spread. And that means we all need to shrink our circle. The more people we bump into, the more chance there is for COVID-19 to spread. It's that simple. So please, be COVID smart. The capacity of our healthcare system to care for our fellow Arizonans is at stake. The well-being of our frontline healthcare workers is at stake. The lives of so many Arizonans are too. Do your part. Shrink your circle of contact. Be COVID smart. All right, let's get to it. It's time to talk about the numbers, healthcare capacity, frontline worker burnout, contact tracing, state metrics for businesses and schools, vaccines, the powers of science, the media, and more as of December 21, 2020.
Let's just say right now that these folks who have been contributing to this roundtable have been giving their time selflessly all year long, starting with Mr. Will Humble from the Arizona Public Health Association. How are you, sir?
Thanks, John. Nice to be here.
Glad to have you back. Also from Arizona State University, Dr. Joshua LeBaire. Josh, how are you?
I'm good, as always. Great to be here.
Glad to have you too, and even more glad to see Dr. Nicholas Vasquez. Doctor, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm also grateful that you put all your time and effort into this podcast and we're able to spend this time together. So thank you.
You are too kind. Let's get started. Josh? We're so excited to hear from you about the numbers. Tell us what's going on.
Well, the numbers are horrible. 7-day trailing averages, around 8,000 new cases a day. We are second only to California in the entire Western United States. So there was a period there where Colorado and New Mexico and a few other states were really rising quickly, but we came up from behind and passed them all. It does look to me a little bit like things are stabilizing a little bit in the state in terms of every day we're around the same now. We'll see if that holds or if we accelerate again. We have not turned the corner to start seeing any deceleration, that's for sure. I think probably more importantly, though, the numbers in the hospitals are what's frightening, is that more than half the cases in the ICUs are COVID cases, and close to half of the beds in the hospitals are COVID cases, which is astonishing when you think of all the possible ailments that could bring someone to a hospital that many. And obviously, Nick can probably comment more on those things, but doesn't look good.
Honestly, that's what struck me over the last few days the most, isn't the 93% capacity on the ICUs and all, but rather that 50% of everybody in the hospital is there for COVID. and that's ICU and regular beds. That tells you how much displacement is going on.
Yeah.
About how many people with other conditions are not in the hospital who should be, and that just are not able to get in. That's the measure of the displacement, I think.
Right.
We would not be at 50% in a normal year.
People are getting sent home early, presumably, or they're just not coming in for things because of it.
Where does that compare to June and July? Did we have that kind of census for COVID?
I don't think we ever got to 50. Well, I don't know.
But it is a dramatic number to have more than half of everybody in the hospital there for COVID.
Nick, how's work?
I work later today. I've been off for a little while. I would say that burnt would be the word I'd use. A lot of people that I know have gotten COVID, gotten over it, and gone back to work. But as far as just the morale, I hear stuff like people are applying or looking for different jobs, or, you know, the ICU docs are burnout. It's a lot of emotional struggle right now. Beyond that, trying to find spaces for beds. The strange thing is you were talking about displacement, my mind goes right to a couple of patients that should definitely have come in a lot earlier, but for some reason they maintained it at home and ended up with gangrene in their feet. I am not sure how to phrase this all, like come into the ER, but be careful, don't bring in COVID, but come get checked. It's definitely having an impact on people's willingness to seek medical care. And for what that's worth, it's making things a lot harder to have a positive outcome. I think mirroring the country, we're all ready for this to be over, and it doesn't look like that's really going to happen anytime soon.
I was over at Valleywise this last week, and I was able to tour one of the COVID wards. It's a converted pediatric ward that's now a COVID ward. They have these HVAC system. They created negative pressure rooms with these big giant tubes so that the rooms are negative pressure. I was talking to the ICU nurses there, and they were here in July, and they said that the people are coming much sicker than they were in July. For example, she said they're coming in with blood pressure through the roof because they hadn't been taking any blood pressure medications all year. Whereas in July, maybe they had only not been taking blood pressure meds for a little while, and now it's been a long time. Not just that, but other medical conditions that were unresolved but manageable, but are not being managed. And then they come in, and that's what they were saying, is that the people seem a lot sicker now than over the summer when they do get in. I mean, ICU is ICU, but this is ICU where they're in even worse than you would think.
Yeah, well, I can echo that. The number of bowel perforations that I've seen in my career versus in the last 2 weeks is just kind of stunning. Like, folks are having issues and not coming in. By the time they're coming in, they're just a lot sicker. Our admission rates have gone up, but the overall visit number have gone down. It makes it very hard, given the business of medicine, to have really sick, intense patients that there's only a few of them. You spend your time with them, you try to give them as best care as you can, but the weirdness of medicine is I'll get paid more for reducing a risk fraction than I will for saving someone's life, which still maddens me. It's just kind of a real challenge right now to keep the hospitals going.
Will, last podcast, you closed out by saying, don't get sick right now because you don't want to go to the hospital right now. We have even higher numbers now in terms of hospital census. It's not just the proportion of COVID cases, but the overall systemic strain. Talk to us about what will be coming based on what's already baked in the cake. And by that, I'm talking about contingency and crisis standards of care. What does that mean clinically? What does it mean to Arizonans seeking medical care of any kind in the coming weeks and months?
Well, I'll start in, and then Dr. Vasquez might want to jump in too. But Nick, do you agree that we're already in contingency standards of care right now? So contingency standards of care means it's not normal operating procedure, but you're not making life and death decisions. If someone comes in, you're not scoring patients against each other, but rather you're doing things like someone shows up in the emergency department and normally, given their condition, they would be given a bed upstairs on a general floor for monitoring for a couple of days, but instead you have to send them home because they can't spare that space upstairs. Or it could mean that somebody is in a general ward bed, and normally, if this was, say, September or October, they'd be placed up in an intensive care bed where there's more intensive staffing ratios and so forth. But because there are sicker people already up there, they're not able to move that patient up to the ICU floor. So we're not at crisis standards of care where you have people on the ICU floor and you're deciding who to withhold care from. When the system is totally saturated and you can no longer use the surge line to move patients and your ICU beds are maxed out and you don't have the resources, whether it's people or stuff or both, then you have to make those decisions. So we're not in the crisis standards of care yet, but I think we're certainly in contingency standards of care. Do you guys agree with that?
Based on your definition of what the people ought to get versus what they do get, as far as a bed or a placement or say a nursing ratio, I would say we've been on the contingency plan for weeks. We're doing the best we can. You said it yourself, you visited Valleywise and they have an entire PD floor that got turned into an ICU. That's a contingency, right? There's no bed for PD anymore. So off we go. We've got these beds and I can staff them with a nurse and call it an ICU. And it's good enough because I got the 2-to-1 ratio and the close monitoring. But whether it's where I work or around the valley or even around the country, I would say we've been there for weeks. This is the general feedback that I'm getting from the physicians that I talk to. Just the stuff that I know that's going on around the valley is, yeah, that contingency is certainly the case. But I have not yet heard about crisis standard of care where you start making decisions on what limited resources go to whom. And for what it's worth, just my 2 cents, is as long as the normal business of medicine goes on, as long as the operating rooms are still allowed to operate, as long as outpatient clinics are still being allowed to operate, that's staff you could potentially be using elsewhere, that'll let us know when we get into the crisis. When that has to stop, then you know you're in the crisis, because right now we're contingency and stretched and stressed, but not crisis.
It's odd though, because if you look at the numbers, the number of people who are ordinarily in the hospital for things other than COVID are much lower than they usually are. So those people, who are they? And is that just electives that are not being admitted? Or
$1 million question that we've been asking since April. Where did the heart attacks go? Where did the strokes go? Where are these folks that are normally our normal stock and trade, abdominal pain, nausea, diarrhea, and just overall volume went down because people had this idea in their mind that the ER is just a mass triage unit. We're not going to go there because I'm going to get COVID.
Right.
We have to try and entreat people, come in, get a telehealth, get at your appointments, get your medicines refilled, have your blood pressure checked. And over time, we've noticed that in general, the trend is about 20-30% less volume than we normally get. And I don't know if that's being made up as an outpatient world or if people are just deciding I can deal with it for now. I get the feeling that that level of I'm just going to live with it and I'm not going to go anywhere is what we're seeing. The folks are coming in sicker because while a majority of people may have been fine if they waited 24 hours and their blood pressure went down all on its own without intervention from the medical system, the new onset diabetic or the dialysis patient or, you know, any of those people with chronic diseases that aren't getting met, those are the folks that I really worry about. Our healthcare system's really good at acute disease. You come in with a heart attack or a stroke or a car accident, we know what to do. But we've also made a large contingency of people that have these chronic diseases where we don't know how to cure them, but we know how to treat them as long as we see you frequently.
Right.
That means come into the visit. That means physically be there so I can take a look at you. That's just not super convenient or really popular right now.
Right.
I'm worried for the general health of the population and our disease management, but I'm hoping this vaccine gets us to normal-ish life sooner rather than later.
Josh, you made the observation that maybe we have reached a new plateau. Maybe, maybe not. We don't know. That's probably the best news that we could offer anybody, given that at this time, the state is still choosing not to do anything to increase mitigation measures. In fact, Will, standards have been changed for keeping businesses open during the pandemic, officially by the state. Can you talk to that, what it means and why we should care?
If you remember back to earlier on this year, there were many of us that were urging the governor and the health director to come up with some numeric criteria to help them make decisions about these non-pharmaceutical interventions, mitigation measures in restaurants, for example, going to takeout service only, having to shut the bars or at least change the business model within bars, shut the nightclubs. Those kinds of decisions we were hoping to tie to objective measures of community spread. And actually, the stakeholder community did it. You know, we got the health department to listen. Business community was involved with this as well. When you look at the metrics that the state health department ended up producing, that was business and academic community came up with that stuff and they adopted it. We were hoping to use community metrics to help drive that so you would have an objective way of making decisions. And they did that. And so once the pause happened, remember the bars closed in late June and were closed all the way through July to early August. And restaurants were takeout service only. Remember that second time around, that mini shutdown, they called it a pause. That ended at a point. And it ended by the state health department coming up with some metrics for community spread. And as they got met, the restrictions could be lifted and the businesses would sign attestations that they'll follow some basic mitigation measures. Over time, it worked. Think about how well those interventions worked. When we shut the bars and the nightclubs and had the restaurants go back to takeout through the month of July, there was a 75% reduction in community spread. That was the intervention. Plus, the governor finally allowed the cities and counties to have face covering ordinances. Those two things really did a terrific job at slowing the spread of this thing. There was objective measures emerging from that. Same thing with the schools. We pushed for school metrics and community spread so that schools could use that information to help make their decisions. And I've been critical of the state health department a lot through this, but I thought they did a really good job with those business metrics and the school opening metrics. And I think there was a really useful tool. Well, Friday, a couple of days ago, the health director, Dr. Chris, just announced that they were just going to change them. And basically, they changed the metrics so that really the bottom line is you can never have substantial spread anymore. The way they changed it because right. So what it means is they're not using the metrics for any policy decisions. What I object to is just if you're going to get rid of the metrics, just say, look, we don't believe in the metrics anymore. We're going to let the bars and restaurants and nightclubs stay open. But I don't like the way it was changed without any kind of public input. You just changed the metrics and the guidance and then your journalists found out about it and made a story.
And it's just an interesting phenomenon. We basically eliminated the category that would create shutdown. And the health director's response to the media was, well, it works for opening, but it doesn't work for closing. And I'm paraphrasing dramatically.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's what she said.
I have not seen the data that was referred to. So she referred to data suggesting that transmission is not happening at businesses. But I don't know where that information comes from.
How do you say that? I think the one thing we can certainly say after all this time with COVID is you can say that sitting indoors without a mask next to a bunch of people promotes transmission.
Yeah. It's going to be true that a lot of transmission is going to happen at homes for that same reason, but it's going to enter the home via some communication with somebody that's not in the home. And that could easily be happening in restaurants or bars.
And it's not just that the restaurants and bars are those kinds of physical environments that spread the virus. It's an invitation to socialize outside of your circle. Yeah, she said that it's intra-family spread with loved ones and this kind of stuff. And that is happening.
Sure. But wait. Brief rant here gonna happen. How the heck do they know that? There's no contact tracing. There's nobody checking.
Yeah.
There's no one keeping track. There's no one hunting down. Just because you say it's not happening just means I'm not even looking. It's like that line from Casablanca. I'm shocked to find this is happening. Just decided that, you know, we are just going to suspend government's role completely because we're pretty sure that we're right because it works really well with our constituency. But we want to have the plausible deniability that we've got standards. So good luck, kids. I find it so frustrating. Yeah.
So journalists were calling me all last week. And even over the weekend saying, where is she getting that data to suggest that bars and restaurants aren't a significant part of the spread? And I said, it's the case investigations that the counties are doing. Pima County's probably doing the best of anybody. And there were capturing 40 to 45% of the cases would respond to the case investigation by text. It wasn't a full-on case investigation, just electronic contact and so forth. And same with Maricopa County. But the case investigation should have messages? That stuff, but they weren't disclosing it and still haven't disclosed that information. I told the journalists, don't give up because that's public information. Don't let them tell you that that aggregated data is private.
Thank you.
friend of mine is a little more risk tolerant than I am, and he took his family on a flight to Turkey and came back through Amsterdam. And through Amsterdam, he flies back to Seattle, and off of Seattle, and I'm not criticizing Seattle, but they had a whole bunch of public health workers on the jetway there to interview them. But the extent of their case transmission was basically, are you sick? No. Okay. Here's a pamphlet on COVID and good luck. Nobody's taking information. There's nobody looking. When we do these case investigations, my understanding is they send individuals a text message and ask them to fill out a form. You could drive a truck through that loophole.
I was a contact of a case. One of my kids got COVID. And so I was a contact. And as soon as he got tested, he was positive. He was at the Embry. This is where he got his test. They sent it to LabCorp. I tweeted about this. Within 30 hours, I had a text from Maricopa County Public Health about Luke. That's my kid. He's got down. So I did it for all the contact tracing for him. His providers, I had their cell numbers. So I knew everyone's cell phone numbers where he was the contact of. And I sent that in using an app to Maricopa County. And then I knew from knowing these providers of his that they got a follow-up text from Maricopa. Now, this is about a month and a half ago when the system was not as overwhelmed as it is now, or maybe a month ago. But at least that part of it worked okay. But okay, I participated fully.
That's fantastic.
Fully.
Yeah. I mean, how many people fully participate? How many people pick up a phone when it's a number they don't recognize?
So they were telling me it's between 40 and 50%, but lower at the younger ages. So people in their 20s were responding at a lower rate. It's better than nothing.
We should have this all figured out in 2 or 3 years.
You know, I mean, yes, okay, maybe I'm arguing for perfect, and you're right, it is better than nothing, and I don't mean to criticize at all the efforts of the people who are doing what they're doing, because I know it's a pandemic, so how do you track down a pandemic? You don't, but in some ways it feels like, hey, I'm 10 grand in debt, but I just found $5 in my pants, so yeah!
The biggest problem with the case investigation is that the vast majority of people that they call don't want to talk about it. A lot of people just don't want to. Up. And that we're seeing that at the schools, we're seeing that at the county level. They view it as snitching. You know, they're very aware that anyone whose name they give or where they were, they'll put somebody else in quarantine. And I think it speaks to the need for these digital apps that will allow us to track who we're near without divulging any information about who they are. But I'm not sure that's going to ever get activated in time for this to be of use. Who knows?
So we'll briefly take a stop in the doom scrolling section of our podcast. Yesterday, word gets out that the UK has a new strain, B.1.17, with an R-naught that is higher, which means it's more transmissible. The estimate is 70% more transmissible. What do we know, and what should Arizonans be thinking? Will?
All I know is stuff I've read from journalism and journalists. I haven't seen anything.
That's right.
In any kind of scientific article at all. So I don't think it's right for me to reproduce and regurgitate what is a flimsy source of information. So I keep waiting to look at something peer-reviewed, obviously early release, or something from CDC to give me a little bit more comfort that I want to use my voice to amplify whatever it is that they're saying.
The British government actually imposed new shutdowns based on this new strain. So they think it's something. And while I understand that we don't know much of anything, the incoming Surgeon General actually made some statements this weekend as well. How do we process what we're hearing so far?
I'll agree with what Will said and will say again. The level of scientific information that's out there is very limited. What we've heard is that there are 7 different mutations, one of which is in the spike protein. What I don't know is any scientific explanation for why it would be more transmissible. The 614 mutation, there are published articles that suggest why that mutation may be more transmissible. Although that mutation does not appear to affect response to vaccine, nor does it affect the severity of the illness. That's one that's predominantly seen in the United States. But this mutation, I've seen no evidence for, you know, explanation other than in a relatively short amount of time, it has become a predominant mutation in England. In England, a lot of people have it.
I don't want to really amplify anything until I can see something from a journal or scientific publication that I can trust. What we have heard from the newspaper type of articles that I've seen is that there's evidence that this has become a dominant strain in that part of England, but I don't know, is that because of the mutation or is there something else going on or is it just for some reason outcompeting the other strains there? I'm not going to draw any conclusions until we know more from a better source.
think the reason it's news because, like, first, Netherlands over the weekend put in a travel restriction for people from the UK. And now they shut the channel between France and England. And so once you see elected officials making dramatic decisions in response to something, even if the evidence of whatever's happening is so limited, it captures your attention because you think, well, geez, if Netherlands is putting in a travel restriction, this must really be bad.
Literally 10 minutes ago, U.S. health officials say they do not need to halt flights from the UK. So there you go. Let's go to the positive, shall we?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Last week, just on Friday, we got ourselves a new vaccine. Let's talk about Moderna. Josh, you want to kick it off?
First of all, both of these vaccines are a testament to some huge advances in modern research and modern biotechnology. The idea that we could have vaccines this good in under a year from the development of a new virus is astonishing and still done with excellent science and still done with careful procedures. So both of the vaccines are using this RNA technology, which I think we're going to see that a lot of folks in the future are going to take this new technology to heart. The trials were done a little bit differently. There appears to be somewhat more side effects for this, the Moderna vaccine. But again, they're mild side effects. They're side effects that are over in a day or two. Soreness, fever, muscle aches, that sort of thing. There are a little bit more clinical data to my eyes that it prevents serious illness, and that may just be because they measured that outcome. I think of the serious outcomes that they looked at in their trial, none of them were in the people who received vaccines, so that's really encouraging news. And of course, their booster shot schedule is a little bit different. It's 28 days instead of 21 days, and it's stable for a month at 4 degrees C. It's to say refrigerator temperature, which makes it a little bit easier to deliver. So probably this vaccine will get delivered more out in rural communities than the Pfizer vaccine, which needs to be near this ultra low temperature storage. So those will be some differences to see. And of course, the other big difference with Moderna is that they already have contracted for 100 million doses already. So there will be a lot of doses available for that vaccine relatively soon, it seems.
Nick, 9:30 this morning. You had to run in with a shot, with a syringe, did you not?
I did. I'm happy to report I got my first vaccine. It was not without a lot of shenanigans to try to actually get scheduled, a lot of consternation among docs. But the vaccine site I went to was well-run, wide capacity, 10 lanes, get your appointment, get your name, verify, here's your risk factors. Okay, let's get you the vaccine, wait about 10 or 15 minutes. How do you feel? I feel fine. And I'm off. All in all, it took half hour. It was just fantastic. Not any different than any normal vaccine that I get.
You probably could have listened to the episode of The Vitalist Spark while you were there.
How did you know? That's exactly what I was doing while I was there waiting.
A wild guess. Just a wild guess. Well, Humble, let's talk about the vaccine rollout and what happened with Pfizer's vaccine last week. Operation Warp Speed hit itself a speed bump.
Well, yes and no. It was super refreshing to see General Perna has this conversation. He gets up behind a podium and he says, I take responsibility for the miscommunication that caused the states to get fewer doses than they thought they were going to get. It's my fault. I approved the protocol that came up with that conclusion. I had a responsibility to ensure it was correct. It was not correct, and it was my fault. It was like, holy smokes. It's so cool to see somebody like own something, because that's how you get better in life. It's just so cool to see someone own it.
It is admirable. I think the question to you, though, is you know that the United States has a working vaccine distribution program, and you talked weeks ago about the idea of the military being added into that chain might cause problems. This appears to be one of those through this misunderstanding, which, yes, the general did absolutely own that responsibility. But it seems like that misunderstanding did cause this issue.
Yeah, states got fewer doses than they expected to get. I think I've come around. I changed my mind on certain things. I remember I changed my mind about emergency use authorization a while back. Now I'm fully supportive of that. I've changed my mind now about the military being involved in the vaccine distribution part of it. And the reason is that if you're going to pick an organization that's good at logistics, the military is good at logistics. it's a core element of what they do. And much of what's happening now with the vaccine allocation and distribution is logistics and analysis. I'm not going to draw a conclusion that this has been unsuccessful based on last week's hiccup with states getting fewer doses than they thought they were going to get. I'm willing to give them a chance. I think it was an okay decision in the end.
We've already talked about journalistic spread of disinformation or misinformation. We've had a lot of things flying through the airwaves about people getting their initial shots and having severe adverse reactions. There is a widely spread video of a nurse fainting after receiving her vaccination on live TV. How do we help people understand things like that?
I'm not going to bag on media because media is just media. They put stuff up, we engage with it. The business model for media is to get us to pay attention. They sell attention. Ultimately, what gets our attention, because our brains work this way, is negative, is far more interesting to us than positive. We're three times more likely to click on a negative story than we are a positive story. And while we are upset that the media, you know, sends us all these negative stories, it is our attention that we choose to click on things where, see, they were right. I knew it. We were going to get hurt. They're out to get us. And I posted on social media of me actually getting the shot. And oddly enough, I made it a video where they get me in the arm and you see the plunger go down. And then somebody said, you're the first person I've seen where they showed me the actual shot, not the cap of the needle. Like, there's no trust. It is just kind of crazy. But we live in this world where we are able to turn on news, internet, and information at any time. And our predilection is to look for the negative, to look for the thing that's going to hurt us, to look for that tiger lurking in the woods. It's going to get us. And we are mostly the ones at fault. If we're paying attention to negative stuff and it's making us mad, we can always turn it off. But I don't know very many people who do that.
I feel like you just described a Cleveland sports fan, but yes, Will, go ahead.
Yeah.
This is years ago now, maybe 15 years ago. I was in getting my hepatitis A and B vaccines in my primary care doc, and I needed pertussis. I needed a few at that visit. Everything went black from the sides and I woke up on the ground. And I said, is that the allergic reaction? And they go, no, that's called vasovagal. But that's what fainting is. It's your mind can be a powerful thing.
Yeah.
And I got the shot and my mind played a game with me. And I woke up on the ground with a picture of an elephant from the doctor's office on my chest. So it happens. It's called vasovagal.
Well, I'm sure Nick has had this happen. I know I have been called to code blues many times to the phlebotomy lab, and you rush down there and it's someone getting a blood draw and they just passed out when they saw the needle go in. I mean,
yeah, it's they don't watch.
That's all the time.
I was watching the needle go in and I just lost it.
Gentlemen, it's the end of the year. I would like you each in succession as your closing thought to raise a glass to 2020. And offer a toast.
Easy peasy. I will raise a toast to science. Science had a good year and a bad year. The bad year was all of this preprint stuff came out and was taken as gospel right away. We learned that good science takes time, but the scientific method has illuminated the dark ever since it came about. And we now live in a world where I got vaccinated because of a scientific freaking miracle that continues to happen every day. But I will ask that we take it with the knowledge that good science takes time and investment. But if we get our normal lives back, it will be because of the scientific effort that was done this year.
I'm going to raise my glass to community spirit. I think that all kinds of noise happened this year, but there have been a huge swell of community spirit, people who volunteered, certainly for our testing program who came out in hours. We asked for volunteers, and in hours, we had several hundred. That's how fast people stepped up to try to help out. And people have continued to do that. So that's my toast.
We should raise a glass, too, to the community spirit that evolved amongst the universities to create the modeling that really helped us understand what was going on in Arizona. So raising a glass to U of A, NAU, and ASU for the work that was done on modeling in Arizona. Will Hummel, who are you raising a glass to?
Boy, I'm going to raise my glass to Nick and Josh because those were such good toasts. There's some really talented public health workers that... That's who I'll toast, is the public health professionals working in environments that must be very distressing because they see the magnitude of the mistakes that are being made by their leadership and they stay at their post and they do their best.
I'll drink to that.
Yep.
Do I need a reason to drink? I thought it's a pandemic. I thought we all got a free pass.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Josh. And thank you, Will. Your toasts to public health staffers, to the community, and to the progress of science in 2020 are surely ones that we can all raise a glass toward. For many, the year can't end soon enough, but that doesn't mean we cannot look back as you three did and appreciate what we've been through. It certainly hasn't been a model year, but the year did have a great model when it came to COVID, and that model tells us that our challenges are far from over. So please, please be COVID smart. Make your holiday season as safe as you possibly can for everyone. Wash up, mask up, keep a heads up, and shrink your circle of contact. The fewer people we interact with, the less chance there is for COVID to spread. It really is that simple. Help us avoid hospital capacity issues and crisis standards of care. Now is truly the time to double down on healthy, low-risk choices. The Vitalist Spark podcast is taking a break, but we'll be back in 2021. In the meantime, our back catalog of episodes awaits your ears. There is a lot to listen to, including guests from across the state and national experts, too. Visit us on the web at vitalisthealth.org/podcast. Check out all of our current and past episodes on Spotify, or simply reach into that podcast app you're using right now and select another show to find out what's going on related to health and well-being in Arizona. That's it for this episode. The takeaways from this dialogue belong at the family dinner table as much as they do in your place of business, in city and town halls, and in the domains of healthcare and public health. So please share this independent episode far and wide. Subscribe to The Vitalist Spark to get notified as soon as new episodes are released. Or listen to The Vitalist Spark just like you listen to your favorite music on Spotify. Give us your feedback wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can give us your input the old-fashioned way. Your corrections, complaints, and compliments are all welcomed by emailing us at feedback@vitalisthealth.org. Finally, remember this. With great responsibility comes great power. We'll see you back on the road to well-being soon.